Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kiran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
My name's Aaron Wendland. I'm Vision Fellow in Public Philosophy at King's College London. I'm also a Senior Research Fellow at Massey College in the University of Toronto. I'm a Heidegger scholar by trade, but I imagine most people know me through my public work. That is, I'm the philosophy editor at the New Statesman, where I commission articles for the Agora series. And then I produce a bunch of philosophically inspired episodes for Ideas on CBC Radio.
So I've always wanted to ask you how the two parts of your philosophical life either fit together or don't. So on the one hand, there's Heidegger, who has a certain kind of intellectual celebrity and a kind of social influence, not always benign social influence,
right,
but is not a kind of public accessible philosopher by ordinary standards. And then there's your work in doing public philosophy and making it accessible. I mean, do those two fit together for you? Is there a tension, or are they just separate things?
Yeah, it's interesting. I agree that Heidegger isn't, in some ways, he's the furthest from publicly accessible. But I found that I learned a lot by reading Heidegger, and it helped me think about the world around me. And in some ways, I had to translate, like, there were these very difficult ideas that seemed valuable to me. And I had to, in some ways, work and struggle with them. But in that sort of work and struggle and translating them into something I understood, it then enabled me to sort of understand the world around me and see it in all kinds of interesting and exciting ways. So I thought there was something valuable in translating these difficult ideas into something that either I understood or that were more publicly accessible, and then using them to sort of analyze and understand the world. And this is kind of how I see the work I do in public philosophy. And so I guess that is kind of the connection. Heidegger helped me see and understand the world, but it did require some translation and work. But once I translated it and did that work, I thought this was something valuable both for myself, and I thought I have potentially a skill at this, so let's help other people do this as well.
That's great. I have another sort of early question that doesn't fit into the format, but makes sense and is sort of inevitable given the format, which is that Iris Murdoch, the inspiration for the podcast late in her life, was writing a book about Heidegger that,
right,
I think one chapter of it has been published in a collection. The rest of it, I think, is going to be published, but hasn't been.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you've ever come across, sort of the Murdoch's engagement with Heidegger, or is that sort of off your radar?
Yeah, I mean, I heard about this project, or that she late in her life was interested in Heidegger, but I see the sort of overlap between her, for lack of a better term, lived experience, sort of existentialism, her novels. I mean, in Being in Time, Heidegger begins it. I think part of the reason why it's so compelling, even though it's so dense and difficult, is that he's like, I'm going to try and figure out the meaning of being by offering an analysis of human beings in their everyday existence. This is the first division of Being in Time. And so he talks about things like idle talk and working in a workshop and gossip and stuff that's in some ways very close to everyday life. And when Murdoch is writing her novels, these are very close to everyday life. And I think paying close attention to the everyday is something that novelists do and something that Heidegger and phenomenologists do. And so I think this is kind of the connection between their work. And I can see why Murdoch would want to read Heidegger and could potentially be attracted to his work. But I haven't actually read her scholarship or this book that you're talking about, or I guess maybe it's not out, so this is why.
It's not out. No. I think someone is editing it, and it will eventually come out. So maybe then we can reconvene to talk about what you make of it. Yeah,
that'd be fascinating.
So I'm gonna go on to the first official question inspired by Murdoch, who wrote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth." So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question for me. I think in some ways I understand temperament as my general disposition towards the world, or something like my point of view. And insofar as my point of view is the basis upon which I sort of understand and interpret the world, it affects everything I do. And so it has an impact, obviously, on my philosophy. But I can't talk about everything. So maybe there, I think, are three ways my sort of temperament influences sort of my ability to do philosophy or my desire to do philosophy. And I think the first one I'd like to talk about is when I was a graduate student, a friend of mine said I was the king of delayed gratification.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, and in response to that, I said, no, I'm the king of no gratification.
Uh-huh.
And the idea behind that was that there's no sort of end to philosophy. There's no answers. When you do come up with a tentative answer, there's always more questions. Oh, I figured out what I think of freedom, or what freedom means, or this is what freedom is. And once you've kind of got a hold on that, then there are all these other questions. Well, if you have this concept of freedom, what does that mean for politics and political philosophy? And what does that mean for ethics? And so there's just no end to philosophy. So in order to do philosophy, you kind of have to be satisfied with, ironically, potentially never having an answer, or it never coming to an end. So delayed gratification, I think, is something that helps me do philosophy, or my ability to never be satisfied, I guess. I suppose the second and potentially odd personality trait that nevertheless dovetails with my desire or ability to do philosophy is that I've always been a bit of a sort of risk taker, or I'm kind of an adrenaline junkie. So like when I was in high school, I raced motocross at a very sort of high level, and I did extreme sports and this kind of stuff. Now, I know it's potentially funny to think of philosophy as somehow something an adrenaline junkie would do, but it involves sort of risks, and not even just risks about the job market, because God, we all know that, but it involves kind of questioning who you are and what you're going to do and the values you inherited, and doing that is risky, right? It can cause an existential crisis, and this can be sort of disconcerting. And so I think my desire to sort of take risks partially explains my desire or interest in doing philosophy. And in some ways, I think it also explains why I got into existentialism, and I'm interested in things like cultural transformation and change, and those things, again, require risk. And I guess the third and final personal quirk or trait that influences my philosophy or my ability to do philosophy is my family. They're pretty high strung or high energy people. And so I kind of always want to do something, and I want to kind of act. And again, this may seem odd for a philosopher, but this is how I see my public philosophy in a way, that there's all this stuff going on in the world, and I can contribute to it in some way by wrestling with current affairs, by applying sort of philosophical ideas to these current affairs to, for lack of a better term, make a difference in the world, do something in the world. And so I think my desire to get out and act in the world explains my desire to do public philosophy.
I mean, I really love this idea of the risk-seeking adrenaline junkie who's drawn to the thrill of philosophy, the danger of philosophy.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the things you described have a kind of, they do have a kind of negative aspect in some ways. There's a kind of leaning into frustration. There's aiming for risk. There's angsty anxiety to be doing things and being impatient. Do you also see sort of positive sides? I mean, I feel like one thing about philosophy is being never ending, that there are always more questions and things are always unresolved, is that you never run out. There's a certain kind of reassurance that philosophy is not going away.
Yeah, in some ways you don't get bored, right? One way to look at this is that, you know, there's this risk of, the risk of, let's say, anxiety or boredom is that because there's always more questions, because there's always more things to do, I'm not bored with my life. I don't suffer this sort of existential anxiety because philosophy always gives me something to do. Now, there are existentialists who'd say that I'm acting in potentially bad faith or I'm being inauthentic by chasing these questions and not sort of stopping and reflecting. But anyway, there's this weird sort of paradox because philosophy involves both. It involves asking the question and stopping and reflecting. But then you have to sort of give answers, at least if you're going to keep your job and get tenure and this kind of stuff. So that's kind of the way I would see it. Yeah, there's this motivation that gives you something to do. It gives you, in sort of existential terms, it gives you meaning and purpose.
Well, there's a kind of transition, I think, from talking about temperament to the second question I want to ask you, which is whether you think of philosophy more as a solitary individual or as a communal activity.
Yeah, this is interesting. I think it also is worth kind of dividing up the, if I can divide them up, the sort of public philosophy hat and the academic philosophy sort of hat. My public philosophy work is, I think, just communal by definition. I edit other people's work, and when I'm commissioning stuff for my New Statesman series, what I do is, okay, there's this current event happening. I do not have expertise on all the branches of philosophy, and I don't know everything about everything happening in the world. So what I do is, when there's this particular event, say there's currently we're dealing with refugees flooding from Ukraine into Poland, I do not work on migration or refugees, but there are plenty of people in philosophy who do. So I reach out to them and ask them if they have some insight to share that can help the broader public understand what's at stake and what is happening in the world. So it involves being a public philosopher, working with different people who have different ideas. And then editing is a communal exercise because we work together to develop their ideas. They have this academic expertise, but they might not necessarily have the ability to sort of write and communicate with the public. So we work together to produce something that hopefully helps the broader public understand current events or current affairs. So my public philosophy, I think, is very communal. The academic, I think there's a communal and a sort of solitary side. So I've edited a lot of collections, or I've edited a couple collections, and I'm working on a couple others. And what was interesting about this is that when I was a graduate student, the best work on Heidegger was often found in edited collections. And so I just took that as a norm, that what you do if you're going to be a Heidegger scholar is you contribute to edited collections and you work with others to produce edited collections. And this might not have been the best for my career because, at least in the UK, edited collections don't count for anything in terms of things like the research excellence framework. But what I later learned is that the best work on Heidegger ended up in, or oftentimes ended up in, these edited collections because nobody in Mind or Nous or the Journal of Philosophy would publish Heidegger work. So it was just some weird quirk. But I had, from the very beginning as a graduate student, thought, okay, working with others, contributing to collections is part of what it means to do philosophy. I suppose on the solitary side, when it comes to academic stuff, is that the choice of what you work on is up to you. That there are all these possibilities, but ultimately I decide this is what I'm going to work on. And that, I think, is a very personal and individual and sort of solitary decision. But once you do the work, again, you give your work to others, you get feedback on. But I think that decision is what is very solitary about academic philosophy.
I think it's really interesting to sort of draw out the ways in which your work in public philosophy, a lot of work in public philosophy, is collaborative. I mean, there's a side to it that I guess I worry about, or that troubles me about my own work in public philosophy, which is that in academic philosophy, there's sort of venues in which seminars, basically classroom settings, in which there's just sort of direct two-way interaction with an audience. And one thing about public philosophy is if it takes the form of writing, as opposed to doing sort of philosophy meetups or something, the sort of communication is very indirect. Like it's a way of presenting philosophy in which it's often hard to get the sort of dialogue with the audience going directly. I don't know if you have thoughts about that feature of public philosophy. I mean, I don't know if there's if there are comments on the articles that appear in the New Statesman in which there's real engagement, or if there's a kind of way to make that happen.
Yeah, this is interesting. I see especially with public philosophy of writing, it's sort of you work with other academics, you put your ideas out there, but apart from comments in a Reddit feed or at the bottom of the article, you don't quite know, in the same way that you do, say, when you're teaching a student, what the reaction of your audience is. There isn't always this two-way street.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think there is this kind of dialectic between academic public philosophy and then the application of public philosophy to, say, current affairs, right? That when you take an academic idea, you make it publicly accessible, and then you use that sort of accessible version of this difficult philosophical idea to understand the world around you. Oftentimes, understanding the world around you pushes back and gives you new avenues for research, right? So maybe it's helpful to give an example that, you know, I work on Heidegger. He has a lot of stuff to say about the philosophy of technology and the impact technology is having on the world around us. So, for example, treating the world as a resource leads to environmental degradation. Okay. He has a story to say about how and why that happens and how our assumptions about the world lead us to reducing the world to resources. And then you sort of like apply Heidegger's ideas to the real world. And then the question is, okay, so we see what the problem is. Heidegger's helped us understand why technology is dangerous and what assumptions we have about the nature of reality that lead us to reduce it to resources for production and consumption. Then the question becomes, okay, what do we do? And how do we deal with it? And this requires sort of further research. So I think there's a dialectical process where you take ideas developed in the academy and apply it to current affairs. And this raises new questions that then require research. So there is a dialectic in this way, but it's different, I think, than the one you were asking about.
Maybe I can ask question three as a kind of follow-up to that about the limits of philosophy and making a difference and the need for this sort of dialectic. So if you weren't a philosopher, what would you do instead?
Yeah, this is interesting. I've thought about this quite a bit during the course of my life. And maybe the first thing I'll say is that when I was in high school, apart from racing these motocross bikes, is I was a shop hand for a construction company. And basically this involved the workers being out on a construction site and coming back to the shop with all kinds of dirty equipment and broken stuff. And my job was to sort of clean it and put things in order and make sure it was ready to go out again the next day or the next week. And I thought there was something sort of incredibly satisfying about this because it was clear what I needed to do. When I cleaned the stuff, it was all in order and ready to go. And taking this sort of mess and cleaning it up was very, very satisfying for me. Maybe I'm obsessive compulsive or something, but that I found really pleasurable. And I don't know if that means I would want to be a shop hand for the rest of my life. And maybe I shouldn't say this to my contributors to the New Statesman, but maybe this desire to sort of clean something up has had an impact on my desire and the enjoyment I get in my role as an editor. But I think there's also something sort of, I don't know, Sisyphean, or it speaks to the value of repetition in human life that, you know, I got better at cleaning all these tools and getting things ready. And I took a lot of sort of satisfaction about doing this over and over and over again and getting better. But I don't know if I would actually be a shop hand for the rest of my life. So I think the honest answer is I've always kind of had an interest in maybe joining the Canadian Reserves this wasn't really a possibility that was on my horizon until I was, say, too old to do something like that. But if I had to go back and do it again, I might be interested in like trying to make the special forces or military intelligence or security services. And I think part of this fits into my adrenaline junkie, risk taker, sense of adventure personality. But I think there's more to it than that, that there's a certain kind of discipline and, or maybe even virtue or character development that comes with, say, being a soldier or being in the military. If you were doing military intelligence, there's obviously all kinds of sort of problem solving involved. And so there's risk, there's the cultivation of virtue, there's, you know, you have to use your brain to think about these complex situations. But then I actually think there's also just something incredibly valuable about defending an idea or defending a way of life. So we're talking, and a couple weeks ago, the Russians invaded Ukraine. And my wife is Estonian, so the first thing I did was get on an airplane in Toronto and fly to Estonia. The Estonians are very nervous because a lot of the things Putin is saying about Ukraine, he could easily say about Estonia and the Baltic states. So they feel very much under threat. And when I was there, I could really feel the value of, like, they really appreciate their way of life and the institutions and democracy that they've developed since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And this is something worth defending. And I find that really compelling and something valuable in it. So if I was younger and realized that this was something that was a possibility and open to me, maybe in my early 20s, that's what I would have done instead of go to grad school.
Yeah, for listeners, I'm not sure when this will air, but we're recording it in the early weeks of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And that is, so I have a kind of choice here about whether to lean into the serious topic, and I'm going to lean away from it to something more frivolous instead and ask you about your time as a shop hand. I kind of love this origin story of someone who ends up being a Heidegger expert, starting out working with tools and making sure they're ready to hand. It's kind of fanciful to draw a connection there, but or is it? Is it entirely fanciful to draw a connection between your kind of engagement with practical activity and the fact that you work on a philosopher for whom that's such a central theme?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I do think that I like to tinker with my motocross bike. This involves taking parts out and fixing it after you ride. And so I've always had this, I don't know if practical is the right word, but maybe mechanical interest and tinkering with this kind of stuff and fixing the bike. And I did find the first division of Being in Time particularly compelling, because when he's describing what it means to be a human being in the context of a work environment, where, what it means for a hammer to be the object that it is that it's relative to certain practices humans engage in, like building houses and being carpenters. This felt very familiar to me. So it resonated in a way that partially explains why I was drawn to it. Yeah, as difficult as the text is, and as abstract as the question of the meaning of being might be, his working out of that question in Division One is very concrete. And like I said, this is probably why it's compelling to me.
Well, there's a Heidegger connection, I think, to the next question I'm going to ask you, question four, about works of art. So I don't know if that will come up, but is there a work of art that you love in part for its philosophical depth?
Yeah, so one of my favorite works of art, at least a favorite works of art of the 20th century, is entitled The Man Who Flew to Space from His Apartment. And it's by Ilya Kabakov. It was initially made in 1984 in his apartment in Moscow. I think it's now located in the Pompidou Center, but it's an installation. And Kabakov is famous for what he calls sort of total installations, where you're completely immersed in a work of art or a room or something like this. So he initially built this installation in his apartment in Moscow. And oftentimes people read Kabakov as his works of these total installations were kind of a metaphor or to give you an attempt to feel or experience the totality of the Soviet Union. But I should probably give a brief description of the work for your listeners so they can sort of understand what I'm getting at here. So The Man Who Flew to Space from His Apartment is, you're walking in what is a mock apartment, and you come to the door of this room, and you peer into the door, and you see sort of a square room that is covered, and I mean completely covered, with Soviet propaganda posters about sort of space flight, the, socialist realist virtues of the farmers and the industrialists. And it's all the best sort of Soviet propaganda you could imagine. But the room, apart from the Soviet propaganda, a very sort of bare bones minimum bed is sitting in the room. But then there's this really funny contraption, which you realize is a man-made catapult that there are sort of elastic bands with springs tied to the four corners of the room that go down to sort of a catapult or a slingshot in the middle of the room. And the idea appears to be that the person who lived in the apartment used this handmade catapult to shoot themselves into space. And there's this hole that smashed through the roof of the apartment where he pulled back the catapult, climbed into it, and then shot himself into space. And there's something incredibly sort of comedic about it. It sort of just looks hilarious and implausible. But then apart from the visual of the room, there's text beside the door. And the text is some of his neighbors in the apartment explaining what this person thought they were doing when shooting themselves into space. So the idea is that somehow at just the right time of year, even this meager catapult, if you could just get high enough into the air, some magical energy flow was then going to carry this person into space. So it seems wildly implausible, but the neighbor thinks that, well, maybe he made it. We haven't seen him. He hasn't come back. He could. So they think it's plausible that he might have actually got to space and is now floating sort of happily ever after in the upper sort of atmosphere. So this is, I hope, a description that is sort of accessible, but I encourage the listeners to take a quick peek at it. So as for the philosophical significance of the work, I think there's quite a bit going on. It's often read as a work of escape or immigration, that people are trying to get out of the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union is incredibly oppressive, and it's driving you insane to the point at which you're willing to just fire yourself into space with this homemade catapult. And of course, Kabakov, shortly after producing this work, ended up immigrating to the United States. So he did escape. So people often read it as sort of a work of escape art. But I think there's way more going on in this work than that. So in some ways, it's a bit about utopia. It's about space flight in the Soviet Union as some kind of utopic vision, some kind of collective activity that's designed to show the greatness of the Soviet Union. There's a certain motif of, you know, we're shooting ourselves to heaven. So there's salvation. We're getting out of this world and moving to the next one. And now thinking about it, I can't think of all these tech billionaires who are building rockets to try and sort of either escape this world, or I'm not sure exactly what they're doing. But there's definitely something utopian about this project. And I think he sort of plays with the idea of utopia and dystopia here, that the Soviet Union is, you know, imagined as this sort of utopia, but here's somebody who's desperately trying to get out of it, to shoot themselves into space. But what I think is sort of really interesting about this is that what's pretty clear is that this person didn't actually make it to space when you read the neighbor's commentary. It's pretty clear that this person died, and that there is no escape. And the point Kabakov is trying to make is that this life is brutal and there is no escape. And the best way we can deal with it is something, there's something heroic. We can heroically confront the challenges of life, you know, the way the space program does or the way this person does. But then there's also a comedic take to it, that instead of dealing with the challenges of life in this sort of heroic way, we're going to confront the difficulties and challenges of life through this work of art, because it's so funny. He's like, another way to respond to it is just to laugh, to poke fun at it, of all the sort of heaviness. And so I think there's a certain existentialism in this, that how you approach life, you can be utopian, you can take it seriously, you can try to achieve this utopia, or confronted with the difficulties in life, you can just laugh at it and poke fun at it. So I think these are two ways of kind of reading the work that he's playing with in this work of art.
Yeah, I really love that installation. And I've seen images of it. I've never been to it physically. Have you? Have you actually been able to go, and can you go inside it? Is that how it works?
Yeah, it's a mock apartment building. And there are a series of different apartments that you get to look into when the exhibition is sort of set up in its totality. So you get to look into sort of different apartment rooms that are part of a typical Soviet apartment block or floor. And then this is one of the rooms you get to look into, but you can't actually walk into this particular room because the quote unquote authorities have boarded the door. So you can look through the door, but you can't actually walk into the room because the authorities, after this person shot himself into space, have kind of blocked the apartment off.
I see.
So you can't walk into the room. So you kind of peek through and see what's happened.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fantastic. It's an amazing, amazing work of art.
I'm going to ask you one final question. This is question 5 with another Murdoch quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote. "What is he afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
Yeah. So I was raised Catholic. My mother was a fairly serious Catholic when I was growing up. And as a child, I found the idea of hell incredibly scary. I suppose if you have a vivid imagination, then hell is just scary. And I guess that's the point. But this meant I was incredibly afraid of failing or doing something wrong. And to this day, I am afraid of failing. And in some way, this is something that's almost impossible to escape. I mean, failure. Life is fragile. Our projects, our relationships, they all require effort and work to sort of sustain. And at any moment, you might not have the ability to sustain them anymore. And so this creates this kind of pressure or fear of failing, of letting the people you love down, of not living up to the expectations you set for yourself in your projects. So failure is something that I think I'm very afraid of.
I mean, it's fascinating to loop that back to your earlier remark that you're the king of delayed or no gratification, since you've sought out a kind of area of pursuit in life in which failure is absolutely pervasive and omnipresent.
Yeah, I wonder if this means I'm some kind of, I don't know, masochist or something by doing philosophy. But yeah, but it can be a source of motivation that if you fear failing, then you might work incredibly hard to prevent that from happening, even if it's going to happen. So yeah, there's maybe a tension there, but I guess I work in it.
Well, we'll end with failure. And I'll say thank you, Aaron, for appearing on the podcast.
Thanks, Kieran. It's been a pleasure.
Aaron Wendland is Vision Fellow in Public Philosophy at King's College London and Senior Research Fellow at Massey College at the University of Toronto. He's written about Kant, Hegel, Husserl, Heidegger, Levinas, Derrida, Danto, and Kuhn, and edits the Agora series in Public Philosophy at The New Statesman. Thanks for listening to 5 Questions.